I remembered, sitting on the green bench beside the little pond that Letty Hempstock had once convinced me was an ocean. Chapter 2. I was not happy as a child, although from time to time I was content. I lived in books more than I lived anywhere else. Our house was large and many-roomed, which was good when they bought it and my father had money. Not good later. My parents called me into their bedroom one afternoon, very formally. I thought I must have done something wrong and was there for a telling off, but no. They told me only that they were no longer affluent, that we would all need to make sacrifices, and that what I would be sacrificing was my bedroom, the little room at the top of the stairs. I was sad. My bedroom had a tiny little yellow wash basin they had put in for me, just my size. The room was above the kitchen and immediately up the stairs from the television room, so at night I could hear the comforting buzz of adult conversation coming from below through my half-open door, and I did not feel alone. Also, in my bedroom, nobody minded if I kept the hall door half open, allowing in enough light that I was not scared of the dark, and just as important, allowing me to read secretly after my bedtime, using the dim hallway light to read by if I needed to. I always needed to. Exiled to my little sister's huge bedroom, I was not heartbroken. There were already three beds in there, and I took the bed by the window. I loved that I could climb out of that bedroom window onto the long brick balcony, that I could sleep with my window open and feel the wind and the rain on my face. But we argued, my sister and I argued about everything. She liked to sleep with the door to the hall closed, and the immediate arguments about whether the bedroom door should be open or shut were summarily resolved by my mother writing a chart that hung on the back of the door, showing that alternate nights were mine or my sister's. Each night, I was content or I was terrified, depending on whether the door was open or closed. My former bedroom at the top of the stairs was let out, and a variety of people passed through it. I viewed them all with suspicion. They were sleeping in my bedroom, using my little yellow basin that was just the right size for me. There had been a fat Austrian lady who told us she could leave her head and walk around the ceiling, an architectural student from New Zealand, an American couple whom my mother scandalized made leave when she discovered they were not actually married. And now there was the opal miner. He was a South African, although he had made his money mining for opals in Australia. He gave my sister and me an opal each, a rough black rock with green-blue-red fire in it. My sister liked him for this and treasured her opal stone. I could not forgive him for the death of my kitten. It was the first day of the spring holidays, 3 weeks of no school. I woke early, thrilled by the prospect of endless days to fill however I wished. I would read. I would explore. I pulled on my shorts, my t-shirt, my sandals. I went downstairs to the kitchen. My father was cooking while my mother slept.
"Actually, you can't. And I gave you your chance. You threatened me. Empty threats."
"I don't make threats," said Letty. "I really wanted you to have a chance."
And then she said, "When you looked around the world for things like you, didn't you wonder why there weren't lots of other old things around?"
"No, you never wondered. You were so happy it was just you here, you never stopped to think.
Gran always calls your sort of thing fleas, Scarthatch of the Keep. I mean, she could call you anything. I think she thinks fleas is funny. She doesn't mind your kind. She says you're harmless enough, just a bit stupid. That's because there are things that eat fleas in this part of creation. Varmints, Gran calls them. She don't like them at all. She says they're mean and they're hard to get hold of and they're always hungry."
"I'm not scared," said Ursula Monkton. She sounded scared. And then she said, "How did you know my name?"
went looking for it this morning. And looking for other things, too. Some boundary markers to keep you from running too far, getting into more trouble. And a trail of breadcrumbs that leads straight here, to this room. Now open the jam jar, take out the doorway, and let's send you home. I waited for Ursula Monckton to respond, but she said nothing. There was no answer, only the slamming of a door and the sound of footsteps fast and pounding, running down the stairs. Letty's voice was close to me, and it said she would have been better off staying here and taking me up on my offer. I felt her hands tugging at the cloths on my face. They came free with a wet, sucking sound, but they no longer felt alive. And when they came off, they fell to the ground and lay there, unmoving. This time there was no blood beaded on my skin. The worst thing that had happened was that my arms and legs had gone to sleep. Letty helped me to my feet. She did not look happy. "Where did she go?" I asked. "She's followed the trail out of the house, and she's scared. Poor thing. She's so scared." "You're scared, too." "A bit, yes. Right about now she's going to find that she's trapped inside the bounds I put down, I expect," said Letty. We went out of the bedroom. Where the toy soldier at the top of the stairs had been, there was now a rip. That's the best I can describe it. It was as if someone had taken a photograph of the stairs and then torn out the soldier from the photograph. There was nothing in the space where the soldier had been but a dim greyness that hurt my eyes if I looked at it too long. "What's she scared of?" "Well, you heard. Varmints." "Are you scared of varmints, Letty?" She hesitated just a moment too long. Then she said, simply, "Yes." "But you aren't scared of her, of Ursula." "I can't be scared of her. It's just like Gran says, she's like a flea all puffed up with pride and power and lust, like a flea bloated with blood. But she couldn't have hurt me. I've seen off dozens like her in my time. One has come through in Cromwell's day. Now there was something to talk about. He made folk lonely, that one. They'd hurt themselves just to make the loneliness stop, gouge out their eyes or jump down wells, and all the while that great lummocking thing sits in the cellar of the Duke's Head, looking like a squat toe big as a bulldog." We were at the bottom of the stairs, walking down the hall. "How do you know where she went?" "Oh, she couldn't have gone anywhere but the way I laid out for her." In the front room, my sister was still playing chopsticks on the piano. Da-da-dum-da-da, da-da-dum-da-da, da-da-dum-da-dum-da, dum-da-da. We walked out of the front door. He was nasty, that one, back in Cromwell's day, but we got him out of there just before the hunger birds came. "Hunger birds? What Gran calls varmints, the cleaners." They didn't sound bad. I knew that Ursula had been scared of them, but I wasn't. Why would you be scared of cleaners? Chapter 11. We caught up with Ursula Monckton on the lawn by the rose bushes. She was holding the jam jar with the drifting wormhole inside it. She looked strange. She tugged at the lid and then stopped and looked up at the sky. Then she looked back to the jam jar once more. She ran over to my beech tree, the one with the rope ladder, and she threw the jam jar as hard as she could against the trunk. If she was trying to break it, she failed. The jar simply bounced off and landed on the moss that half covered the tangle of roots and lay there, undamaged. Ursula Monckton glared at Letty. "Why?" she said. "You know why," said Letty. "Why would you let them in?" She had started to cry, and I felt uncomfortable. I did not know what to do when adults cried. It was something I had only seen twice before in my life. I had seen my grandparents cry when my aunt had died in hospital, and I had seen my mother cry. Adults should not weep, I knew. They did not have mothers who would comfort them. I wondered if Ursula Monckton had ever had a mother. She had mud on her face and on her knees, and she was wailing.
I heard a sound in the distance, odd and outlandish, a low thrumming, as if someone had plucked at a taut piece of string.
"It won't be me that lets them in," said Letty Hempstock. "They go where they wants to. They usually don't come here because there's nothing for them to eat. Now there is."
"Send me back," said Ursula Monkton. And now I did not think she looked even faintly human. Her face was wrong, somehow, an accidental assemblage of features that simply put me in mind of a human face, like the knobbly grey walls and lumps on the side of my beech tree, or the patterns in the wooden headboard of the bed at my grandmother's house, which, if I looked at them wrongly in the moonlight, showed me an old man with his mouth open wide, as if he were screaming. Letty picked up the jam jar from the green moss and twisted the lid.
"You've gone and got it stuck tight," she said. She walked over to the rock path, turned the jam jar upside down, holding it at the bottom, and banged it, lid side down, once, confidently, against the ground. Then she turned it the right side up and twisted. This time the lid came off in her hand.
She passed the jam jar to Ursula Monkton, who reached inside it and pulled out the translucent thing that had once been a hole in my foot. It writhed and wiggled and flexed, seemingly in delight at her touch. She threw it down. It fell onto the grass, and it grew, only it didn't grow, it changed, as jam jar to Ursula Monkton, who reached inside it and pulled out the translucent thing that had once been a hole in my foot. It writhed and wiggled and flexed, seemingly in delight at her touch. She threw it down. It fell onto the grass, and it grew, only it didn't grow, it changed, as if it was closer to me than I had thought. I could see through it from one end to the other. I could have run down it if the far end of that tunnel had not ended in a bitter orange sky. As I stared at it, my chest twinged again, an ice-cold feeling as if I had just eaten so much ice cream that I had chilled my insides. Ursula Monkton walked toward the tunnel mouth. How could the tiny wormhole be a tunnel? I could not understand it. It was still a glistening, translucent, silver-black wormhole on the grass, no more than a foot or so long. It was as if I had zoomed in on something small, I suppose, but it was also a tunnel, and you could have taken a house through it. Then she stopped, and she wailed. She said,
"The way back."
Only that.
"Incomplete," she said. "It's broken. The last of the gate isn't there."
And she looked around her, troubled and puzzled. She focused on me, not my face, but my chest. And she smiled. Then she shook. One moment she was an adult woman, naked and muddy. The next, as if she was a flesh-colored umbrella. She unfurled. And as she unfurled, she reached out and she grabbed me, pulled me up and high off the ground, and I reached out in fear and held her in my turn. I was holding flesh. I was 15 feet or more above the ground, as high as a tree. I was not holding flesh. I was holding old fabric, a perished, rotting canvas, and beneath it I could feel wood. Not good, solid wood, but the kind of old, decayed wood I'd find where trees had crumbled, the kind that always felt wet, that I could pull apart with my fingers, soft wood with tiny beetles in it and woodlice all filled with thread-like fungus. It creaked and swayed as it held me.
"You have blocked the ways," it said to Letty Hempstock.
"I never block nothing," Letty said. "You've got my friend. Put him down." She was a long way beneath me, and I was scared of heights, and I was scared of the creature that was holding me.
"The path is incomplete. The ways are blocked. Put him down, now, safely. He completes the path. The path is inside him."
I was certain that I would die then. I did not want to die. My parents had told me that I would not really die,
Not the real me, that nobody really died when they died, that my kitten and the opal miner had just taken new bodies and would be back again soon enough. I did not know if this was true or not. I knew only that I was used to being me, and I liked my books and my grandparents and Letty Hempstock, and that death would take all these things from me. I will open him. The way is broken. It remains inside him. I would have kicked, but there was nothing to kick against. I pulled with my fingers at the limb holding me, but my fingernails dug into rotting cloth and soft wood, and beneath it something as hard as bone, and the creature held me close. "Let me go," I shouted. "Let me go." "No." "Mummy," I shouted.
"Daddy!"
Then,
"Letty, make her put me down."
My parents were not there. Letty was. She said, "Scarthatch, put him down. I gave you a choice before. Sending you home will be harder with the end of your tunnel inside him, but we can do it, and Gran can do it if Mum and me can't. So put him down." It is inside him. It is not a tunnel. Not any longer. It does not end. I fastened the path inside him too well when I made it, and the last of it is still inside him. No matter. All I need to do to get away from here is to reach into his chest and pull out his beating heart and finish the path and open the door. It was talking without words, the faceless flapping thing. Talking directly inside my head, and yet there was something in its words that reminded me of Ursula Monkton's pretty musical voice. I knew it meant what it said. "All of your chances are used up," said Letty, as if she were telling us that the sky was blue, and she raised two fingers to her lips, and shrill and sweet and piercing sharp, she whistled. They came as if they had been waiting for her call. High in the sky they were, and black, jet black, so black it seemed as if they were specks on my eyes, not real things at all. They had wings, but they were not birds. They were older than birds, and they flew in circles and in loops and walls, dozens of them, hundreds perhaps, and each flapping unbird slowly, ever so slowly, descended. I found myself imagining a valley filled with dinosaurs, millions of years ago, who had died in battle or of disease, imagining first the carcasses of the rotting thunder lizards bigger than buses, and then the vultures of that eon, grey, black, naked, winged but featherless, faces from nightmares, beak-like snouts filled with needle-sharp teeth made for rending and tearing and devouring, and hungry red eyes. These creatures would have descended on the corpses of the great thunder lizards and left nothing but bones. Huge they were, and sleek, and ancient, and it hurt my eyes to look at them. "Now," said Letty Hempstock to Ursula Monkton, "put him down." The thing that held me made no move to drop me. It said nothing, just moved swiftly like a raggedy tall ship across the grass toward the tunnel. I could see the anger in Letty Hempstock's face, her fists clenched so tightly the knuckles were white. I could see above us the hunger birds circling, circling. And then one of them dropped from the sky, dropped faster than the mind could imagine. I felt a rush of air beside me, saw a black, black jaw filled with needles and eyes that burned like gas jets, and I heard a ripping noise like a curtain being torn apart. The flying thing swooped back up into the sky, with a length of grey cloth between its jaws. I heard a voice wailing inside my head and out of it, and the voice was Ursula Monkton's. They descended then, as if they had all been waiting for the first of their number to move. They fell from the sky onto the thing that held me, nightmares tearing at a nightmare, pulling off strips of fabric, and through it all I heard Ursula Monkton crying. "I only gave them what they needed," she was saying, petulant and afraid. "I made them happy." You made my daddy hurt me, I said as the thing that was holding me flailed at the nightmares that tore at its fabric. The hunger birds ripped at it, each bird silently tearing away strips of cloth and flapping heavily back into the sky to wheel and descend again. I never made any of them do anything, it told me. For a moment, I thought it was laughing at me. Then the laughter became a scream so loud it hurt my ears and my mind. It was as if the wind left the tattered sails then, and the thing that was holding me crumpled slowly to the ground. I hit the grass hard, skinning my knees and the palms of my hands. Letty pulled me up, helped me away from the fallen, crumpled remains of what had once called itself Ursula Monkton. There was still grey cloth, but it was not cloth. It writhed and rolled on the ground around me, blown by no wind that I could perceive, a squirming, maggoty mess. The hunger birds landed on it, like seagulls on a beach of stranded fish, and they tore at it as if they had not eaten for 1,000 years and needed to stuff themselves now, as it might be 1,000 years or longer before they would eat again. They tore at the grey stuff, and in my mind I could hear it screaming the whole time as they crammed its rotting canvas flesh into their sharp maws. Letty held my arm. She didn't say anything. We waited. And when the screaming stopped, I knew that Ursula Monkton was gone forever. Once the black creatures had finished devouring the thing on the grass, and nothing remained, not even the tiniest scrap of grey cloth, then they turned their attentions to the translucent tunnel, which wiggled and wriggled and twitched like a living thing. Several of them grasped it in their claws, and they flew up with it, pulling it into the sky while the rest of them tore at it, demolishing it with their hungry mouths. I thought that when they finished it, they would go away, return to wherever they had come from. But they did not. They descended. I tried to count them as they landed, and I failed. I had thought that there were hundreds of them, but I might have been wrong. There might have been 20 of them. There might have been 1,000. I could not explain it. Perhaps they were from a place where such things as counting didn't apply, somewhere outside of time and numbers. They landed, and I stared at them, but saw nothing but shadows. So many shadows. And they were staring at us. Letty said, "You've done what you came here for. You got your prey. You cleaned up. You can go home now." The shadows did not move. She said, "Go." The shadows on the grass stayed exactly where they were. If anything, they seemed darker, more real than they had been before. "You have no power over us."
"Perhaps I don't," said Letty, "but I called you here, and now I'm telling you to go home. You devoured Scar Thatcher the Keep. You've done your business. Now clear off."
"We are cleaners. We came to clean."
"Yes, and you've cleaned the thing you came for. Go home."
"Not everything," sighed the wind in the rhododendron bushes and the rustle of the grass. Letty turned to me and put her arms around me.
"Come on," she said, "quickly."
We walked across the lawn rapidly. "I'm taking you down to the fairy ring," she said. "You have to wait there until I come and get you. Don't leave, not for anything."
"Why not?"
"Because something bad could happen to you. I don't think I could get you back to the farmhouse safely, and I can't fix this on my own, but you're safe in the ring. Whatever you see, whatever you hear, don't leave it. Just stay where you are, and you'll be fine."
"It's not a real fairy ring," I told her. "That's just our games. It's a green circle of grass."
"It is what it is," she said. "Nothing that wants to hurt you can cross it. Now stay inside." She squeezed my hand and walked me into the green grass circle. Then she ran off into the rhododendron bushes and was gone.
Chapter 12. The shadows began to gather around the edges of the circle. formless blotches that were only there, really there, when glimpsed from the corners of my eyes. That was when they looked bird-like. That was when they looked hungry. I have never been as frightened as I was in that grass circle with the dead tree in the centre on that afternoon. No birds sang, no insects hummed or buzzed. Nothing changed. I heard the rustle of the leaves and the sigh of the grass as the wind passed over it, but Letty Hempstock was not there, and I heard no voices in the breeze. There was nothing to scare me but shadows, and the shadows were not even properly visible when I looked at them directly. The sun got lower in the sky, and the shadows blurred into the dusk, became, if anything, more indistinct, so now I was not certain that anything was there at all. But I did not leave the grass circle. "Hey, boy!" I turned. He walked across the lawn toward me. He was dressed as he had been the last time I had seen him, a dinner jacket, a frilly white shirt, a black bow tie. His face was still an alarming cherry red, as if he had just spent too long on the beach, but his hands were white. He looked like a waxwork, not a person, something you would expect to see in the Chamber of Horrors. He grinned when he saw me looking at him, and now he looked like a waxwork that was smiling, and I swallowed and wished that the sun was out again. "Come on, boy," said the opal miner. "You're just prolonging the inevitable." I did not say a word. I watched him. His shiny black shoes walked up to the grass circle, but they did not cross it. My heart was pounding so hard in my chest, I was certain that he must have heard it, my neck and scalp prickled. "Boy," he said, in his sharp South African accent, "they need to finish this up. It's what they do. They're the carrion kind, the vultures of the void. Their job, clean up the last remnants of the mess, nice and neat, pull you from the world, and it will be as if you never existed. Just go with it. It won't hurt." I stared at him. Adults only ever said that when it, whatever it happened to be, was going to hurt so much. The dead man in the dinner jacket turned his head slowly until his face was looking at mine. His eyes were rolled back in his head and seemed to be staring blindly at the sky above us, like a sleepwalker. "She can't save you, your little friend," he said. "Your fate was sealed and decided days ago when their prey used you as a door from its place to this one, and she fastened her path in your heart." "I didn't start it," I told the dead man. "It's not fair. You started it." "Yes," said the dead man. "Are you coming?" I sat down with my back to the dead tree in the center of the fairy ring, and I closed my eyes, and I did not move. I remembered poems to distract myself, recited them silently under my breath, mouthing the words but making no sound. Fury said to a mouse that he met in the house, "Let us both go to law, I will prosecute you." I had learned that poem by heart at my school. It was told by the mouse from Alice in Wonderland, the mouse she met swimming in the pool of her own tears. In my copy of Alice, the words of the poem curled and shrank like a mouse's tail. I could say all of the poem in one long breath, and I did, all the way to the inevitable end. "I'll be judge, I'll be jury," said cunning old Fury. "I'll try the whole cause and condemn you to death." When I opened my eyes and looked up, the opal miner was no longer there. The sky was going grey, and the world was losing depth and flattening into twilight. If the shadows were still there, I could no longer perceive them. Or rather, the whole world had become shadows. My little sister ran down from the house, calling my name. She stopped before she reached me, and she said, "What are you doing?" "Nothing. Daddy's on the phone. He says you have to come and talk to him." "No, he doesn't." "What?" "He doesn't say that. If you don't come now, you'll be in trouble." I did not know if this was my sister or not. But I was on the inside of the grass circle, and she was on the outside. I wished I had brought a book with me, even though it was almost too dark to read. I said the Mouse's Pool of Tears poem again, in my head. Come, I'll take no denial, we must have a trial for really this morning, I've nothing to do. Where's Ursula? Asked my sister. She went up to her room, but she isn't there any more. She's not in the kitchen, and she's not in the Lulas. I want my tea. I'm hungry. You can make yourself something to eat, I told her. You're not a baby. Where's Ursula? She was ripped to shreds by alien vulture monsters, and honestly, I think you're one of them, or being controlled by them, or something. Don't know. I'm telling Mummy and Daddy when they get home that you were horrible to me today. You'll get into trouble. I wondered if this was actually my sister or not. It definitely sounded like her, but she did not take a step over the circle of greener grass into the ring. She stuck her tongue out at me and ran back toward the house. Said the Mouse to the Cur, such a trial, dear sir, with no jury or judge will be wasting our breath. Deep twilight dusk, all colourless and strained. Mosquitoes whined about my ears and landed, one by one, on my cheeks and my hands. I was glad I was wearing Letty Hempstock's cousin's strange, old-fashioned clothing then, because I had less bare skin exposed. I slapped at the insects as they landed, and some of them flew off. One that didn't fly away, gorging itself on the inside of my wrist, burst when I hit it, leaving a smeared teardrop of my blood to run down the inside of my arm. There were bats flying above me. I liked bats, always had, but that night there were so many of them, and they made me think of the Hunger Birds, and I shuddered. Twilight became, imperceptibly, night, and now I was sitting in a circle that I could no longer see at the bottom of the garden. Lights, friendly electric lights, went on in the house. I did not want to be scared of the dark. I was not scared of any real thing. I just did not want to be there any longer, waiting in the darkness for my friend who had run away from me and did not seem to be coming back. Said cunning old Fury, I'll try the whole cause and condemn you to death. I stayed just where I was. I had seen Ursula Monkton torn to shreds, and the shreds devoured by scavengers from outside the universe of things that I understood. If I went out of the circle, I was certain they would do the same to me. I moved from Lewis Carroll to Gilbert and Sullivan. When you're lying awake with a dismal headache and reposes tabooed by anxiety, I conceive you may use any language you choose to indulge in without impropriety. I loved the sound of the words, even if I was not entirely sure what all of them meant. I needed to wee. I turned my back on the house, took a few steps away from the tree, scared I would take one step too far and find myself outside the circle. I urinated into the darkness. I had just finished when I was blinded by a torch beam, and my father's voice said, "What on earth are you doing down here?" I'm just down here, I said. Yes, your sister said. Well, time to come back to the house. Your dinner's on the table. I stayed where I was. No, I said, and shook my head. Don't be silly. I'm not being silly, and I'm staying here. Come on. And then, more cheerful, come on, handsome George. It had been his silly pet name for me when I was a baby. He even had a song that went with it that he would sing while bouncing me on his lap. It was the best song in the world. I didn't say anything. I'm not going to carry you back to the house, said my father. There was an edge starting to creep into his voice. You're too big for that. Yes, I thought, and you'd have to cross into the fairy ring to pick me up. But the fairy ring seemed foolish now. This was my father, not some waxwork thing that the Hunger Birds had made to lure me out. It was night. My father had come home from work. It was time. I said, Ursula Monkton's gone away, and she's not ever coming back. He sounded irritated then. What did you do? Did you say something horrible to her? Were you rude? No, He shone the torch beam onto my face. The light was almost blinding. He seemed to be fighting to keep his temper under control. He said, "Tell me what you said to her." "I didn't say anything to her. She just went away." It was true, or almost. "Come back to the house now."
"Please, Daddy, I have to stay here."
"You come back to the house this minute," shouted my father at the top of his voice, and I could not help it. My lower lip shook, my nose started to run, and tears sprang to my eyes. The tears blurred my vision and stung, but they did not fall, and I blinked them away. I did not know if I was talking to my own father or not. I said, "I don't like it when you shout at me."
"Well, I don't like it when you act like a little animal," he shouted.
And now I was crying, and the tears were running down my face, and I wished that I was anywhere else but there that night. I had stood up to worse things than him in the last few hours, and suddenly I didn't care anymore. I looked up at the dark shape behind and above the torch beam, and I said, "Does it make you feel big to make a little boy cry?" And I knew as I said it that it was the thing I should never have said. His face, what I could see of it in the reflected torchlight, crumpled and looked shocked. He opened his mouth to speak, then he closed it again. I could not remember my father ever at a loss for words, before or after. Only then. I felt terrible. I thought, "I will die here soon. I do not want to die with those words on my lips." But the torch beam was turning away from me. My father said only, "We'll be up at the house. I'll put your dinner in the oven." I watched the torchlight move back across the lawn, past the rose bushes and up toward the house, until it went out and was lost to sight. I heard the back door open and close again. "Then you get some repose in the form of a doze with hot eyeballs and head ever aching, but your slumbering teems with such horrible dreams that you'd very much better be waking." Somebody laughed. I stopped singing and looked around, but saw nobody. "The nightmare song," a voice said. "How appropriate." She walked closer until I could see her face. Ursula Monckton was still quite naked, and she was smiling. I had seen her torn to pieces a few hours before, but now she was whole. Even so, she looked less solid than any of the other people I had seen that night. I could see the lights of the house glimmering behind her, through her. Her smile had not changed. "You're dead," I told her. "Yes, I was eaten," said Ursula Monckton.
"You're dead. You aren't real."
"I was eaten," she repeated. "I am nothing. And they have let me out just for a little while from the place inside them. It's cold in there and very empty. But they have promised you to me, so I will have something to play with, something to keep me company in the dark. And after you have been eaten, you too will be nothing. But whatever remains of that nothing will be mine to keep, eaten and together, my toy and my distraction, until the end of time. We'll have such fun." A ghost of a hand was raised, and it touched the smile and it blew me the ghost of Ursula Monckton's kiss. "I'll be waiting for you," she said. A rustle in the rhododendrons behind me, and a voice, cheerful and female and young, saying, "It's okay, Gran fixed it. Everything's taken care of. Come on." The moon was visible now, above the azalea bush, a bright crescent like a thick nail paring. I sat down by the dead tree and did not move. "Come on, silly. I told you, they've gone home," said Letty Hempstock. "If you're really Letty Hempstock," I told her, "you come here." She stayed where she was, a shadowy girl. Then she laughed and she stretched and she shook, and now she was only another shadow, a shadow that filled the night. "You are hungry,"
said the voice in the night, and it was no longer Letty's voice, not any longer. It might have been the voice inside my own head, but it was speaking aloud. You are tired. Your family hates you. You have no friends, and Letty Hempstock, I regret to tell you, is never coming back. I wished I could have seen who was talking. If you have something specific and visible to fear, rather than something that could be anything, it is easier. Nobody cares, said the voice, so resigned, so practical. Now step out of the circle and come to us. One step is all it will take. Just put one foot across the threshold and we will make all the pain go away forever. The pain you feel now and the pain that is still to come. It will never happen. It was not one voice, not any longer. It was two people talking in unison, or 100 people, I could not tell. So many voices. How can you be happy in this world? You have a hole in your heart. You have a gateway inside you to lands beyond the world you know. They will call you as you grow. There can never be a time when you forget them, when you are not in your heart, questing after something you cannot have, something you cannot even properly imagine, the lack of which will spoil your sleep and your day and your life until you close your eyes for the final time, until your loved ones give you poison and sell you to anatomy. And even then you will die with a hole inside you, and you will wail and curse at a life ill-lived. But you won't grow. You can come out, and we will end it, cleanly. Or you can die in there, of hunger and of fear. And when you are dead, your circle will mean nothing, and we will tear out your heart and take your soul for a keepsake. Perhaps it will be like that, I said to the darkness and the shadows. And perhaps it won't. And perhaps, if it is, it would have been like that anyway. I don't care. I'm still going to wait here for Letty Hempstock, and she's going to come back to me. And if I die here, then I still die waiting for her, and that's a better way to go than you and all you stupid, horrible things tearing me to bits because I've got something inside me that I don't even want. There was silence. The shadows seemed to have become part of the night once again. I thought over what I'd said, and I knew that it was true. At that moment, for once in my childhood, I was not scared of the dark, and I was perfectly willing to die, as willing as any 7-year-old certain of his immortality can be, if I died waiting for Letty, because she was my friend. Time passed. I waited for the night to begin to talk to me again, for people to come, for all the ghosts and monsters of my imagination to stand beyond the circle and call me out, but nothing more happened. Not then. I simply waited. The moon rose higher. My eyes had adjusted to the darkness. I sang under my breath, mouthing the words over and over. You're a regular wreck with a crick in your neck and no wonder you snore, for your head's on the floor and you've needles and pins from your soul to your shins and your flesh is a creep, for your left leg's asleep and you've cramp in your toes and a fly on your nose, you got fluff in your lung and a feverish tongue and a thirst that's intense and a general sense that you haven't been sleeping in clover. I sang it to myself, the whole song, all the way through, 2 or 3 times, and I was relieved that I remembered the words, even if I did not always understand them. Chapter 13. When Letty arrived, the real Letty, this time, she was carrying a bucket of water. It must have been heavy, judging from the way she carried it. She stepped over where the edge of the ring in the grass must have been, then she came straight to me. Sorry, she said. That took a lot longer than I expected. I didn't want to cooperate, neither, and in the end it took me and Gran to do it, and she did most of the heavy lifting. It wasn't going to argue with her, but it didn't help, and it's not easy. What? I asked. What are you talking about? She put the metal bucket down on the grass beside me, without spilling a drop. The ocean, she said. It didn't want to go. It gave Gran such a struggle that she said she was going to have to go and have a lie down afterwards. but we still got it into the bucket at the end. The water in the bucket was glowing, emitting a greenish-blue light. I could see Letty's face by it. I could see the waves and ripples on the surface of the water, watch them crest and splash against the side of the bucket.
I don't understand.
I couldn't get you to the ocean, she said, but there was nothing stopping me bringing the ocean to you. I said, I'm hungry, Letty, and I don't like this. Mum's made dinner, but you're going to have to stay hungry for a little bit longer. Were you scared up here on your own?
Yes.
Did they try and get you out of the circle?
Yes.
She took my hands in hers then and squeezed them. But you stayed where you were meant to be, and you didn't listen to them. Well done. That's quality, that is. And she sounded proud. In that moment, I forgot my hunger, and I forgot my fear.
What do I do now?
I asked her. Now, she said, you step into the bucket. You don't have to take your shoes off or anything. Just step in. It did not even seem a strange request. She let go of one of my hands, kept hold of the other. I thought, I will never let go of your hand, not unless you tell me to. I put one foot into the glimmering water of the bucket, raising the water level almost to the edge. My foot rested on the tin floor of the bucket. The water was cool on my foot, not cold. I put the other foot into the water, and I went down with it, down like a marble statue, and the waves of Letty Hempstock's ocean closed over my head. I felt the same shock you would feel if you had stepped backwards without looking and had fallen into a swimming pool. I closed my eyes at the water's sting and kept them tightly shut, so tightly. I could not swim. I did not know where I was or what was happening, but even under the water, I could feel that Letty was still holding my hand. I was holding my breath. I held it until I could hold it no longer, and then I let the air out in a bubbling rush and gulped a breath in, expecting to choke, to splutter, to die. I did not choke. I felt the coldness of the water, if it was water, pour into my nose and my throat, felt it fill my lungs, but that was all it did. It did not hurt me. I thought, this is the kind of water you can breathe. I thought, perhaps there is just a secret to breathing water, something simple that everyone could do, if only they knew. That was what I thought. That was the first thing, I thought. The second thing, I thought, was that I knew everything. Letty Hempstock's ocean flowed inside me, and it filled the entire universe, from egg to rose. I knew that. I knew what egg was, where the universe began to the sound of uncreated voices singing in the void. And I knew where rose was, the peculiar crinkling of space on space into dimensions that fold like origami and blossom like strange orchids, and which would mark the last good time before the eventual end of everything and the next Big Bang, which would be, I knew now, nothing of the kind. I knew that old Mrs. Hempstock would be here for that one, as she had been for the last. I saw the world I had walked since my birth, and I understood how fragile it was, that the reality I knew was a thin layer of icing on a great dark birthday cake writhing with grubs and nightmares and hunger. I saw the world from above and below. I saw that there were patterns and gates and paths beyond the real. I saw all these things and understood them, and they filled me, just as the waters of the ocean filled me. Everything whispered inside me. Everything spoke to everything, and I knew it all. I opened my eyes, curious to learn what I would see in the world outside me, if it would be anything like the world inside. I was hanging deep beneath the water. I looked down, and the blue world below me receded into darkness. I looked up, and the world above me did the same. Nothing was pulling me down deeper. Nothing was forcing me toward the surface. I turned my head a little, to look at her, because she was still holding my hand. She had never let go of my hand. And I saw Letty Hempstock. At first, I do not think I knew what I was looking at. I could make no sense of it. Where Ursula Monkton had been made of grey cloth that flapped and snapped and gusted in the storm winds, Letty Hempstock was made of silken sheets the colour of ice, filled with tiny flickering candle flames. 100 candle flames. Could there be candle flames burning under the water? There could. I knew that when I was in the ocean, and I even knew how. I understood it just as I understood dark matter, the material of the universe that makes up everything that must be there but we cannot find. I found myself thinking of an ocean running beneath the whole universe, like the dark seawater that laps beneath the wooden boards of an old pier, an ocean that stretches from forever to forever and is still small enough to fit inside a bucket if you have old Mrs. Hempstock to help you get it in there, and you ask nicely. Letty Hempstock looked like pale silk and candle flames. I wondered how I looked to her in that place, and knew that even in a place that was nothing but knowledge, that was the one thing I could not know. That if I looked inward, I would see only infinite mirrors staring into myself for eternity. The silk filled with candle flames moved then, a slow, graceful, under-the-water sort of a movement. The current pulled at it, and now it had arms and the hand that had never let go of mine, and a body and a freckled face that was familiar, and it opened its mouth, and in Letty Hempstock's voice it said, "I'm really sorry." "What for?" She did not reply. The currents of the ocean pulled at my hair and my clothes like summer breezes. I was no longer cold, and I knew everything, and I was not hungry. And the whole big, complicated world was simple and graspable and easy to unlock. I would stay here for the rest of time in the ocean, which was the universe, which was the soul, which was all that mattered. I would stay here forever. "You can't," said Letty. "It would destroy you." I opened my mouth to tell her that nothing could kill me, not now, but she said, "Not kill you, destroy you. Dissolve you. You wouldn't die in here. Nothing ever dies in here. But if you stayed here for too long, after a while just a little of you would exist everywhere, all spread out. And that's not a good thing. Never enough of you all together in one place, so there wouldn't be anything left that would think of itself as an I. No point of view any longer, because you'd be an infinite sequence of views and of points." I was going to argue with her. She was wrong, she had to be. I loved that place, that state, that feeling, and I was never going to leave it. And then my head broke water, and I blinked and coughed, and I was standing thigh-deep in the pond at the back of the Hempstock's farm, and Letty Hempstock was standing beside me, holding my hand. I coughed again, and it felt like the water fled my nose, my throat, my lungs. I pulled clean air into my chest in the light of the huge, full harvest moon that shone on the Hempstock's red-tiled roof, and for one final, perfect moment I still knew everything. I remember that I knew how to make it so the moon would be full when you needed it to be, and shining just on the back of the house, every night. I knew everything. But Letty Hempstock was pulling me up, out of the pond. I was still wearing the strange old-fashioned clothes I had been given that morning, and as I stepped out of the pond, up onto the grass that edged it, I discovered that my clothes and my skin were now perfectly dry. The ocean was back in the pond, and the only knowledge I was left with, as if I had woken from a dream on a summer's day, was that it had not been long ago since I had known everything. I looked at Letty in the moonlight. "Is that how it is for you?" I asked. "Is what how it is for me?" "Do you still know everything, all the time?" She shook her head. She didn't smile. She said, "Be boring, knowing everything. You have to give all that stuff up if you're going to muck about here." "So you used to know everything?" She wrinkled her nose. "Everybody did. I told you it's nothing special knowing how things work, and you really do have to give it all up if you want to play.
To play what?
This, she said. She waved at the house and the sky and the impossible full moon and the skeins and shawls and clusters of bright stars. I wished I knew what she meant. It was as if she was talking about a dream we had shared. For a moment, it was so close in my mind that I could almost touch it.
You must be so hungry, said Letty, and the moment was broken, and yes, I was so hungry, and the hunger took my head and swallowed my lingering dreams.
There was a plate waiting for me in my place at the table in the farmhouse's huge kitchen. On it was a portion of shepherd's pie, the mashed potato a crusty brown on top, minced meat and vegetables and gravy beneath it. I was scared of eating food outside my home, scared that I might want to leave food I did not like and be told off, or be forced to sit and swallow it in minuscule portions until it was gone, as I was at school. But the food at the Hempstocks was always perfect. It did not scare me. Ginny Hempstock was there, bustling about in her apron, rounded and welcoming. I ate without talking, head down, shoveling the welcome food into my mouth. The woman and the girl spoke in low, urgent tones. "They'll be here soon enough," said Letty. "They aren't stupid, and they won't leave until they've taken the last little bit of what they came here for." The mother sniffed. Her red cheeks were flushed from the heat of the kitchen fire. "Stuff and nonsense," she said. "They're all mouth, they are." I had never heard that expression before, and I thought she was telling us that the creatures were just mouths and nothing more. It did not seem unlikely that the shadows were indeed all mouths. I had seen them devour the grey thing that had called itself Ursula Monkton. My grandmother would tell me off for eating like a wild animal. "You must essen, eat," she would say, "like a person, not a chaza, a pig. When animals eat, they fress. People essen, eat like a person." Fressen. That was how the hunger birds had taken Ursula Monkton. And it was also, I had no doubt, how they would consume me. "I've never seen so many of them," said Letty. "When they came here in the old days, there was only a handful of them." Ginny poured me a glass of water. "That's your own fault," she told Letty. "You put up signals and called them, like banging the dinner bell you were. Not surprising they all came."
"I just wanted to make sure that she left," said Letty.
"Fleas," said Ginny, and she shook her head. "They're like chickens who get out of the hen house and are so proud of themselves and so puffed up for being able to eat all the worms and beetles and caterpillars they want that they never think about foxes." She stirred the custard cooking on the hob with a long wooden spoon in huge, irritated movements. "Anyway, now we've got foxes, and we'll send them all home, same as we did the last times they were sniffing around. We did it before, didn't we?"
"Not really," said Letty.
"Either we sent the flea home, and the varmints had nothing to hang around for, like the flea in the cellar in Cromwell's time, or the varmints came and took what they came here for, and then they went away, like the fat flea who made people's dreams come true in Red Rufus's day. They took him, and they upped and left. We've never had to get rid of them before."
Her mother shrugged.
"It's all the same sort of thing. We'll just send them back where they came from."
"And where do they come from?" asked Letty.
I had slowed down now, and was making the final fragments of my shepherd's pie last as long as I could, pushing them around the plate slowly with my fork.
"That don't matter," said Ginny. "They all go back eventually. Probably just get bored of waiting."
"I tried pushing them around," said Letty Hempstock, matter-of-factly. "Couldn't get any traction. I held them with a dome of protection, but that wouldn't have lasted much longer. We're good here, obviously. Nothing's coming into this farm without our say-so."
"In or out," said Ginny.
She removed my empty plate, replaced it with a bowl containing a steaming slice of spotted dick with thick yellow custard drizzled all over it. I ate it with joy. I do not miss childhood, but I miss the way I took pleasure in small things, even as greater things crumbled. I could not control the world I was in, could not walk away from things or people or moments that hurt, but I found joy in the things that made me happy.